Russia continued its attacks on Ukrainian cities, even as the two sides sit down for another round of peace talks.
It was a big hit. A lot of apartments were completely destroyed, some burned.
Plus, a day after Russia strikes a military base in western Ukraine, killing at least 35, Australia imposes new sanctions on Moscow.
Australian Foreign Minister Maurice Payne said in a statement that many of these oligarchs have facilitated or directly benefited from the Kremlin's illegal and indefensible actions in Ukraine since 2014.
And later in the program, what would it mean to the world if Ukrainian historical sites were lost to the war? Today is Monday, March 14th. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening. I'm Steve Miller. Government officials in Ukraine say that at least one person was killed and at least three others were injured when a shell hit a residential building in Kyiv on Monday morning. Yevgeny Gazenko was there, and he was speaking to Reuters News when he said that he was on a neighboring building when he saw a smoke trail and then an explosion. Gazenko then went to that building and saw a dead body, a man aged around 70, and that of another woman. Yan Busha is in Kyiv and joins us now.
Yeah, there were two attacks here in Kyiv. Day one, this one in the apartment building. The information that I have is that two people got killed. Some others got wounded. I was there. I entered the building. It was a big level of destruction. It's incredible that just two people died. Probably a lot of the apartments were empty because more than 1 million people already left Kyiv. So it was a big hit. A lot of apartments were completely destroyed, some burned. It was pretty incredible. And later on here, like 2 kilometers away from there, another missile hit a bus and destroyed some apartments. At least one person was killed here, exactly where I am. Three others injured. So if it was in a normal situation, a normal day with all the population here, probably we would have way more deaths in a situation like this. Because, you know, it was a big missile. It was not just a mortar that hit this place right now where I am. This afternoon, things are quiet now.
Yeah, and I was wondering if you could also share a little bit about your experiences over the weekend. You were outside of Kyiv on the outskirts where there was fighting between Ukrainian and Russian forces. And unfortunately, Brent Renaud, an American journalist, was killed. You were in the area. So can you kind of describe the circumstances as far as you know?
Yeah, I think it's very difficult to say exactly what happened yesterday in Irpin. I was there. I spent my day there and stayed the day before there. The day before, things were a little bit easy. Not really a lot of combat, not a lot of bombardment. But yesterday, everything was really, really different. We could hear a lot of fighting going on the edges of this little town. It's a 60,000 population town, very close to Kyiv, like 20 kilometers from here. And the bombardments were very, very intense yesterday as well. So it's really hard to say what happened. You know, I just passed that place a few minutes before they got killed. And I didn't see any activities like Russians around or fighting or anything like that. So I really don't know what happened. And I'm sure a lot of our colleagues here asking themselves what exactly happened to him and his friend. You know, he wasn't in the front line at that moment.
You sent in some video reports where we could hear explosions in the not too distance. You were laying on the ground and reporting. You know, can you kind of give us a feeling as to what you heard, what you saw in terms of the actual fighting?
Yes. Right before I was, this was outside Irpin, right outside Irpin. The Russians started bombing a lot this edge of the city, you know, near this bridge. And then we were in this open space where all the journalists gathered to get inside. And then the bombardment started. It was a pretty bad situation because there was no shelters around. So everybody just laid on the ground, hoped for the best. And the bombs were like falling pretty close to us. Not very, very close, but pretty close to us. So we were there waiting for the bombardment stop, and then we could move and leave that place. At that moment, the best thing to do was just lay down, put your head down, wait, and wish that everything will be okay. And it was okay. But everybody was very tense because that was just like, I don't know, 1 hour after we got the information that the American journalists got killed. Everybody was very, really sad at that moment.
Yambusha in Kyiv. Now in Western Ukraine, reporter Anna Chernikova shares a story of her grandparents, whose home was destroyed this weekend by Russian munitions near Kharkiv.
My grandparents are originally from Kharkiv region, from little town of Izum, which is now making headlines because of what is happening there. So this little town has been under the shelling for the past week. And for the past week, we don't really have any connection with them. So we know that there is no cell connection, there is no electricity, there is no water supply. A couple of days ago, we managed to get a call from them. It was just possible because my grandparents' neighbor was able to just climb somewhere up to catch the connection. So what we know so far is that their house is partly destroyed. They are living in a basement, and they are alive. This is what we know. As I remember from what my grandparents told me when I was a child and a teenager, that during the Second World War in 1941, they experienced the same, but my granny was very little at that time. So their house was destroyed and they were living in the same basement they live now. This is probably what a lot of families in such little towns are experiencing, because what I also know from my friends and from my other relatives, unfortunately, this is how these old people, 80-plus people, relate this event.
Anna Chernikova in Western Ukraine. The Associated Press has learned a pregnant woman and her baby have died after Russia bombed a maternity hospital in the besieged city of Mariupol, where she was meant to give birth. The AP's Charles Deledesma continues our coverage.
Images of the woman being rushed to an ambulance on a stretcher had circled the world, epitomizing the horror of an attack on humanity's most innocent. Doctors at another hospital had labored to keep her and her baby alive, but both died. 2 days after the March 9 attack, the AP had talked with Mariana Vishkovskaya, who'd survived the attack on the hospital and had then given birth to her daughter, Veronica. Mariana says, we were lying in wards when glass, frames, windows and walls flew apart. We didn't know how it happened. Some women had time to cover themselves, some didn't. In the chaos after the strike, medics didn't have time to get the dead woman's name after her husband and father came to take away her body. I'm Charles Deledesma.
In other updates, Ukrainian and Russian delegations resumed peace talks on Monday. It's a day after Russia launched a lethal cruise missile attack on a Western Ukraine military base just 25 kilometers from Poland. Poland is a NATO member. At least 35 people died and 134 were wounded in the attack on the International Center for Peacekeeping and Security. The UN Refugee Agency also reports that as of Monday, over 2.8 million refugees have fled Ukraine since Russia launched its invasion, although European Union officials have said 5 million may end up fleeing, while others have put that figure even higher. And a U.S. official said Russia asked China for military equipment to use in its invasion of Ukraine, a request that heightens tensions about the war as top aides from the United States and China governments met on Monday in Rome. Russia has denied it needed China's help. For additional updates, be sure to check out voanews.com/flashpoint. Australia has imposed fresh sanctions on wealthy Russian entrepreneurs because of the Kremlin's invasion of Ukraine. Phil Mercer reports the move is part of Australia's strategy to penalize people of economic and political value to Russia.
The latest round of Australian sanctions targets Russian oligarchs or wealthy business people thought to have close ties to the Kremlin. They include the prominent billionaire Roman Abramovich, the British-based owner of Chelsea Football Club, one of European soccer's most successful teams. He's always denied any close affiliation with Russian President Vladimir Putin. Abramovich is among more than 30 individuals sanctioned by Australia. They include the chief executive of Russian energy company Gazprom, Alexei Miller, and the head of Bank Rossiya, Dmitry Lebedev. Targeted financial sanctions and travel bans against Abramovich, who's one of the richest men in the world, bring Canberra in line with measures taken by British and US authorities. Australian Foreign Minister Maurice Payne said in a statement that many of these oligarchs have facilitated or directly benefited from the Kremlin's illegal and indefensible actions in Ukraine since 2014. Ukrainian community leaders have welcomed various penalties imposed by Australia on Russia since its invasion of Ukraine. Canberra has spent $50 million on missiles and ammunition for Ukrainian forces. But Dmytro Matsapura, a Ukrainian-born associate professor at the University of Sydney Business School, wants Australia and its allies to impose a no-fly zone over Ukraine to stop Russian aerial attacks.
Our army is very brave and they will fight until the end. But what we need is help of the international community, and that includes the military hardware, and it also includes protecting the civilians. So at the moment, our main message is to protect the civilians and to help close the sky from the Russian bombs and Russian attacks and Russian missiles.
Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison said Monday the invasion of Ukraine and the pressure it's put on gas supplies would make the world assess alternative sources of energy. Morrison said the conflict would provide opportunities for Australia's growing hydrogen industry that can power cars and homes.
Right now we're seeing the world reevaluate where it gets its energy from because of the war in Europe. 40% of Europe's gas is dependent on Russia. And so major advanced economies in the world today are considering again what their supply chains are. Japanese government is keen to continue to develop our hydrogen projects and partnerships with them, and that is only heightened by the uncertainty we've seen.
Australian sanctions are part of a US-led campaign to financially isolate Russia and disrupt its financial institutions. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Miller. The United States has banned Russian energy imports and wants Saudi Arabia to increase oil production to mitigate the dramatic spike in gas prices. But just how willing are Gulf states to help bring oil prices down remains to be seen. VOA's senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain has that story.
Fallout from Russia's invasion of Ukraine continues to rattle global energy markets, punishing motorists and others who rely on fossil fuels, days after U.S. President Joe Biden banned Russian oil, gas, and coal imports. The European Union relies on Russia for about 40% of its natural gas and about 25% of the oil it consumes. The 27 EU leaders agreed to cautiously phase out their dependency on Russian energy. Russian President Vladimir Putin blamed the U.S. and Europe for skyrocketing oil and gas prices and said they are now desperate to reach out to major oil-producing countries they had previously sanctioned.
They are already trying at all costs to come to an agreement with the countries against which they themselves have imposed illegitimate restrictions. And they are ready to make peace with Iran and immediately sign all the documents, and with Venezuela.
With prices at the gas pump surging, reports say President Biden reached out to Saudi Arabia. But Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman has not taken his call. Biden did speak with Saudi King Salman on February the 9th. Relations between the United States and the Crown Prince have been strained since the brutal murder and dismemberment of Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi in a Saudi consulate in 2018. Biden has pledged to make the Crown Prince a pariah. But Secretary of State Antony Blinken downplayed any Saudi snub of Biden and said there is encouraging news on oil production from the United Arab Emirates.
Emirati has support for increased production when it comes to OPEC Plus, which I think is an important thing to stabilize global energy markets.
Experts tell VOA there are tensions between Biden and the Saudi Crown Prince, but Biden administration officials have been holding talks behind the scenes in Riyadh. Brian Katulis is vice president for policy with the Middle East Institute.
So I think the main concern is that at a time when gas prices are so high and we're looking to get some cooperation from other countries, including close partners that get security cooperation and assistance, that we would hope that they would do more to help the United States.
Katulis said there is a risk for Saudi Arabia if it refuses to help bring gas prices down.
There'll be political problems here coming from both Republicans and Democrats, that if consumers who are motorists simply don't want to pay the price, they'll look for someone to blame. And I think a country like Saudi Arabia, it has been blamed before.
Biden administration officials have also held talks with oil-rich Venezuela this month and are hoping for a breakthrough in the Iran nuclear talks in Vienna, which could eventually release Iranian oil back into the global market. But the talks have been paused due to new Russian demands for unrestricted trade access with Iran. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
Russia's war in Ukraine has had massive implications in the Horn and Eastern Africa. Humanitarian groups are struggling to help hundreds of thousands of Africans who are already facing food insecurity and are now dealing with a massive deficit in food supplies. Hajir Ma'alam is the regional director of the Horn and Eastern Africa for Action Against Hunger. He tells VOA's Carol Van Dam that 84% of the wheat consumed in Eastern Africa comes from imports, and that 90% of that amount comes from Russia and Ukraine.
Wheat demand in these countries actually varies from one country to the other. Some countries like Eritrea 100% rely on wheat produced in that part of the world. Therefore, the inability to be able to provide these products to this region is going to have massive implication on the ability for the household to have access to food down the line. And this situation is even made worse by the currently biting severe drought in the Horn of Africa, where we have already seen in many households where we did our own assessment, Action Against Hunger's own assessment, we found crop production, cereal harvest, below 80% of what was projected to be harvested this season. Many of the crops have failed. And as a result of that, significant demand on imports to meet the household food needs. What we are seeing already, the compounding effect of the drought, the conflict in this region, and the disruption in supply having massive implication on the nutritional situation of children under five.
You're saying it's kind of like a 1-2-3 punch with not only the drought in the area of Eastern Africa and the Horn, it's the conflict that is happening in the continent there, and also the war in Ukraine from Russia.
That is correct. I think these communities, vulnerable communities, are facing multiple shocks, one after the other, sometimes multiple heat at the same time. And these are vulnerable people that are dependent on casual labor, barely making a living on the basis of these. And we have seen in some areas where we did our assessment, we find more than 26% of the households in those areas even have no income and therefore dependent on food aid. This population are massively impacted by even a small slight change in food prices. And because of this disruption, we are already seeing significant increase. In Mogadishu, our own assessment clearly shows that the prices of wheat have increased by 50% in the last few months. Similarly, other staple food are also prices of staple food are also increasing.
You obviously help people who are the most vulnerable, who can't buy food on their own. But then the people that were going to the market and buying staples for their families, they can't even afford anything anymore, you're saying?
That is correct. We are already seeing increase in population movement. Somalia, for instance, have recorded more than 600,000 people have moved because of this increase in vulnerability, compounded by food price increase and the biting drought as well. And we've seen also population in urban areas massively impacted. What happens is that often when populations are displaced from rural areas, they go and seek refuge with relatives or friends in urban areas. And this is now increasing the burden on this population.
Africa had done a good deal of exporting to Russia and Ukraine, too, before the war. What kinds of exports are we talking about? And how have African farmers and traders been affected since February 24th when Russia invaded Ukraine?
Kenya, for instance, exports tea, flowers, coffee, fruits to Russia at an estimated value of about $87.5 million annually. And because of the suspension to container shipping lines, this has been disrupted. And this export is essential for the survival. And I think because the country is already facing high levels of inflation, there has been already a compounding effect, cumulative effect because of the COVID-19 having massive implication on the tourism sector, which is also one of the other key sectors after agriculture.
Describe where you and your group comes in. What is Action Against Hunger doing to try to help the most vulnerable people in Africa who are not getting enough food to eat because of all these things?
First, we do make efforts to ensure that we can enhance local production. So at Action Against Hunger, we have innovated much more effective ways of growing crops for household consumption and as well for sale at the market by optimizing the use, so growing more on a small piece of land.
Action Against Hunger's regional director for the Horn and Eastern Africa, Hajir Ma'alim, speaking to my colleague, Carol Van Dam. As the war continues to scar the face of Ukraine, UNESCO World Heritage Site managers, museum directors, and professionals met last week to formulate plans on how to preserve the country's heritage sites. The United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization's Ernesto Otone, Assistant Director General for Culture of UNESCO, described to me over Skype what it would mean to the world if Ukraine's historical sites were lost.
It's a loss for humanity. What we are talking is, when we saw the destruction 20 years ago of the Bamiyan Buddhas, everybody remembers. Today, what we see is when there is a destruction of a building, a heritage, a church that are so specifically Ukrainian churches that are very different from other churches in the region, it will be a loss forever. We know that in 30 years, we can rebuild. It's not the preservation of what past creators have given to humanity. So we are very, very concerned, deeply concerned what is happening, because one of the rules of UNESCO is to assess damage. But what we want is prevent the damage. Not to assess, it's part of the job. But what can we do to prevent in a situation where you are far away? And that's why I'm telling you, we are doing what we can to transfer whatever knowledge we can give to the authorities right now. And there is, as you know, many, many volunteers in Ukraine that stay there and that are sleeping in the museum, in the cultural center, because they want to defend whatever they feel that belongs to the identity of Ukraine. And that's a situation where whatever we can do, we are going to continue to do it for them. But if it were another country, we will continue to do it because it's part of the job that we have to do.
Ernesto Otone is the Assistant Director General for Culture of UNESCO. He spoke to me last week over Skype. And that'll do it for us today. Be sure to stay up to date with continuing coverage on Ukraine, as well as news and events from around the world, 24 hours a day at voanews.com. And on our social media platforms, just follow VOA News. On behalf of the entire Flashpoint Ukraine team, thank you very much for listening. Until next time, I'm VOA's Steve Miller. Be well, be safe, and good night.